Hallo. Hallo, hallo, hallo. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, testing.
Ja. Nei, det var forrige gang, det var helt
faktisk. Ok. I think we'll start. Hopefully the sound on the recording is good. Welcome back to IMT 4116. And today we have a guest lecture from Cyber Defense. He's going to talk about chapter 16 and 17, anti-debugging and anti-VM. And without further delay, I'll hand over to him. Alexander, floor is yours.
All right. Welcome to this presentation about chapter 16 and 17, anti-debugging and anti-VMs. A little about myself. My name is Alexander Bjørkaug. I'm a second lieutenant in the Norwegian Armed Forces Cyber Defense. And I'm a full-time malware analyst. And I've been that for about a year now. And I focus mostly on bigger stuff like threat actors, APT, not so much cryptos and crimeware. So I have kind of like the bigger picture and the little bigger league. Yeah. So a little about the lecture. As I said, it's chapter 16 and 17, anti-debugging and anti-virtual machine techniques. We'll be going from about now 18:15 to 12, where the first two sessions are 45 minutes with a break in between. I know for a fact the second session will be a little shorter, the second chapter will be a little shorter, and then it will be 2 hours full lab. You can ask your relevant questions under the presentation if you want. I know that Girulov is on the internet and can take questions from there, so please ask if there are anything under the presentation.
You can just say in the microphone that the lab will not be recorded, but we will be online to answer questions.
Yeah, the labs will not be recorded, but we will be online to answer questions if there are any.
As normal,
he tells me. Yes, I will be going by the book, unless otherwise specified. So I don't have all that much real-life examples, unfortunately. Something to do with confidentiality and so on. But I will be going by the book and some notes from my own experience. All right, so let's begin. Anti-debugging. How to confuse the debugger and the debuggee. So in this section, we're going through a little what anti-debugging is, going through some Windows API calls, talking a little about the process environmental block, and then we're going on to the little more checking of manually checking system flags and so on. Then a little evidence of the debugger, identifying debug behavior, interfering with debugger functionalities and debugger vulnerabilities, and then conclusion. So, what is it? Anti-debugging is the malware checking if somebody is actively stopping the runtime and looking at the code when it's executing. And the malware can check for this in many different ways that we're going to go through in this presentation. So many have probably hopefully debugged already, so you know what debugging is. And anti-debugging is just checking for debugging attached to a program. And its main goal of anti-debugging is mostly just making the analyzing time longer so that malware can, in the wild, can do as it pleases for as long as possible. And the book doesn't show every possibility, but it's quite comprehensive. Okay, so a little on the Windows API calls. These are pretty much the easiest way to check for debugger and the easiest to detect and mitigate with when you are debugging. So the first API call is debugger present. And what it does, it doesn't take any parameters, and it just return a non-zero value if it's being debugged. And what the function does, it goes into the process environmental block. I will come into that a little later, what it is, and checks a flag, is debugged, with that window set when you are attaching a debugger. The second API call is check remote debugger present. And this name is somewhat misleading because you can just give this function a handle to the malware, and it will check the malware that is running and check if there are any debugger presents. And it pretty much do the same as above, but just a little workaround. Yes. There are also other function calls. In the NTDLL library, there are a lot of useful functions that pretty much every other function is a wrapper to. And one of these low-level functions are NTQuery information process. And what it does, it goes to the process and checks if there are any ports open to the debugger to talk to. Because if there aren't any ports, then the debugger can't get the exceptions and can't talk to the program and stop it in the right time. So if there are any debuggers attached, it returns the port number that the debuggers on, or else it's a zero value. And here's a little tricky one, output debug string. And what this function does, it's return, you can send a string to the debugger output window, which is quite useful when you are debugging a real program, because you aren't printing to the console that's running the program, you're printing to the console that the debugger is running in. But what malware does is that it sets, when I try to use my mouse here, it sets an arbitrary value into variable, arbitrary value in variable, and then sets that error to the last error. Then it tries to print to debugger, and if it's the same error that it set, if the new error is same as the error value, that means it could print to debugger, and there are a debugger presence. And if it's a new error value, it means it could not print to the error, not print to the debugger, and therefore there aren't any debuggers. So it's a kind of nifty way to check if there's a debugger. All right. So I mentioned the process environmental block, environment block, the PEB. I'm going through a little what the PEB is, just to understand what you're looking for. So the PEB is made by the OS for every process. And what it is, it's made metadata about the process and the flags that have been set and some paths to the systems. And the PEB is referenced by the FS30 hex in assembly. And that's the address to the start of the PEB. And here we see the structure of the PEB. And as you can see, there are a lot of reserved, unnamed bits, bytes, and D-words because the PEB is undocumented for most of the mostly. But we know a lot of what's in it. But for now, we are interested in the being debugged flag, which is the second byte in the PEB. And we are going to use it when we are manually checking. So, manually checking for a debugger. So into the FS or the segment registry used by the operation system, not the processor, you have the PEB. And you want to check the second byte, as I said. So first off, you get the address to the start of the PEB, process environmental block. And then And then you go to the second byte in that memory location, and just test if there are any values there. And if it aren't, well, then it's not debugger is not attached. And on the other side here, it's the same, just a little another methods to check for the same. Okay. So, you have, as I said, undocumented and reserved locations in the PEB. And we know for a fact that reserved 4 in the picture I've shown in the structure is process heap. And process heap is located on the offset of 18 in PEB. And the start is force flag and then flags. Force flags and flags are pretty much the same, but it's there are flags that must be set for a Windows system to know what to do with the process in runtime. So, the first heap header, as I said, is force flags, and it tells the kernel if it's being debugged. In Windows, that is the offset 10 hex, and the Windows 7 is 44 hex. And this can also be C hex, Charlie hex in XP, and 40 hex in Windows 7. But that's the offset of the flags and not the force flags. Okay. So, what am I actually talking about here? So, to check these force flags, the first byte in the force flag, if there are any debug expressions, you first have to get the address to the PEB, and the red one here. Then you get the address to the PEB and puts it into EAX. Then you go to the offset 18, which is the address for the process heap, offset to the process heap. I should have written there, and move that to the EAX. Then you test on the offset of 10 hex if it's 0. And if it's not 0, then you have a debugger attached. Remember, this is for XP only. Windows 7 force flags starts on 44 hex. So on this last one in green will have to be 44 hex instead of 10 hex.
But it's still 18?
Yeah, it's still 18 in the beginning. Yeah, they should be the same, yeah. I haven't seen any other indications when I've been working. But there could be other places to check as well, but 44, I've seen 44. All right. So there's still more you can manually check. The NT global flag is in the process memory heap. And when a process is run with a debugger, it runs different. The memory heap is made differently. It's natural because the operation systems have to know how to handle this new debugger that's attached. And the PEB has another undocumented location on the offset 68. And if the value in the offset 68 equals 70 hex, then a debugger is true, because there are a lot of flags here that accumulate this value of 70 hex. I don't know really what flags these are, but just remember that 70 is the magic number here. And if it's not 70, then there aren't any debuggers. Alright, so now we're going through something a little more different, not in the assembly code, but a little more checking. And that's evidence of a debugger, because the debugger have to leave behind some information that it's there and it's working, that the Windows can call on it and give it what it needs to work. So inside the registry, you have this, for example, this key, which is the name of the debugger that you are going to, that Windows is going to send its exception handling to. And by standard, when you have a new installation of Windows, that is Dr. Watson. And Dr. Watson is just Windows exception handling. That's not really a debugger in such a way. You could use it as a debugger, I think, but I have never looked into it. And that's the key that Windows look for a name of the debugger. So there's a place the malware can look inside the registry. Also, there are other Windows API calls that indirectly could locate a debugger. For instance, find window and the string only debug, because the API just looks through all the open windows that you have on the desktop and checks if the name is only debug. This could be IDA, this could be x64 debug or something else. Another thing, a little off the book, a malware could, for instance, scan program files for the strings IDA or OLLI. This will also be quite a useful way to check if there are any debugs on the system. You can check with this one. You can't check if it's active, but if there are an IDA instance or an OLLI instance on a system, it's quite a high chance that it's a malware reversing system, and you should probably not do your malicious code. Yes.
If you can repeat the question, if you remember that, into the microphone. You've done a lot of tests. Are there other conditions that can make these tests true, or is it only debuggers that can make them true?
There's a question that's I've done a lot of tests on flags, and if there are any other conditions that could make them true. And I believe not, because these are made by the Windows system. If there aren't any critical failures in the Windows system, they should not be set unless there are a debugger. Because, well, if it's set and something happens with the program and it crashes, then that crash would be sent to a debugger. And if they aren't there, well, then the system would fail critically. So at least in the PEB, is debugger present, and the force flags are critical for the system to work. So those are a sure sign that they are a debugger and should not be placed set otherwise.
And then another question that is almost the same but a little bit different. If these tests are negative, do they then say that there is no debugger?
Yeah. So another question here is that if the return value is negative on this test, could there still be a debugger, if I got it correctly? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could hook the tests and set like plugins or other programs that force give the program the wrong values, so that the program, the malware that checks, thinks that it checks the right place and gets the wrong value back, and then hide the debugger. I'm going to go a little through that later. But it is possible, but for Windows to work, you have to have those flags set. So you can have other programs to forcefully give the wrong answer back. And that's a good way to go about it.
You can build malware.
Yeah, I would not call it malware, but I could build another program to give false information. All right. So, there are other ways to identify or other ways to check if there are debugger present by the way you are coding the malware. We're going through three examples here. That's int scanning, checksum check, and timing checks. And these are just three. There are probably an endless way to do this, but these are the three most commonly used. Alright, so int scanning. Before going to int scanning, you have to go a little through what breakpoints are, for those that maybe aren't that into it. Because breakpoints, they temporarily edits the code. Because when you, for instance, are in IDA, and you press, I want a breakpoint here, it's just a red line, but you can still see the assembly instructions. But what's really happening here, that when you run, when you're running the code, that red bar you're placing will be replaced by an int 3. So for instance, I want to place a breakpoint on call EIX, and I start running. This call EIX will be temporarily placed, edited in the code, physically edit in the code, to an int 3. And when you're hitting that point, the debugger knows that, all right, on this place in memory, there were a call EIX, so now I just have to switch around and give and set the call EIX back. But even if it's temporary, you are still editing the code, so you can still check for it, even if it's if it isn't visible to the debugger, the debuggee or the analyst. So int 3 is a software interrupt, and it's used by debuggers to know that you have to stop the running here and wait for further instructions. And the opcode for int 3 is CC and hex. And what int 3 scanning is just going through your own code. Malware is going through its own code and check if there are any unwanted CCs in the hex values. So, a little explanation here. This is a quite common one on int 3 scanning. So, as we can see here in the red, all this is pretty much just the start. And what this does, it's make EDI equal to the address of call $time 5. And that's where we're going to start scanning. Here, on the blue, this is the counter. Sometimes the size of the file, size of the function, something that's critical to you, and it is placed into ECX. Then you have this green one here, the green one here, you place into EAX what you are going to look for. And it's this, in this example, it's CC or int 3. And lastly, but the most importantly, you have this long assembly here. Most of you have probably seen this before, and that's repeat until equal, scan, repeat until equal. And what it does, it's check every byte from that starting point for CC. And if it hits a CC, then it stops, sets zero flag to one, and goes to the next instruction. As we can see here, if zero, debugger detected. So,
does it stand for scan single byte?
Yeah, that's correct. Scan single byte is correct. Repeat until equal scan single byte. Okay, so checksum checks. As I said, breakpoints edit the code, and therefore, if you hash your code or part of your code, and then an analyst puts in a breakpoint or two, then the new hash will be different. That's a commonly used way to check for if the Windows update is the legit Windows update, and this hashing of files and checking if the hash is correct is quite common and useful in both malware and legitimate programs. So if the new hash is different than the old hash, that's probably written into the code. Well, then it's been tampered with, and you should probably not run through your malicious code or something else entirely. Okay, So timing check, another quite common one. Because stepping through code is slow. Processor works on billions of cycles a second, but stepping you can probably do 1 per second, probably less when you are reading and looking through what's happening with the flags and so on and registering. So timing check is literally just checking how fast the process is running. And in assembly, there's an instruction called RDTSC, which returns the number of ticks of process cycles since last reboot. So here we have an example on that the RDTSC, then you're XORing out the ECX, put the value of the last ticks into ECX, do another get ticks, and then subtract the old one, the new one with the old one, and then compare with an arbitrary value to see if it's been far too long since those two get last ticks. And if it's within the value, well, then maybe there aren't any debuggers. And here is put on another RDTC for a good measure, probably another one further down and another check, I would imagine. Okay, but we don't always have to work in the Windows, the assembly plane. We can also do this in the Windows API. And here there are at least two useful API calls, query performance counter and get tick count. Both of these, I think query performance counter returns another value than get tick count, but in essence they're both doing the same thing, at least in this check. And it works just in the same way as RDTSC, but just with C. So in this example, you get the tick count, put the value into A, do your malicious stuff, get the tick count again, put it in B, find the delta, and check the delta against the arbitrary value. So if there have been stepping through the malicious activity, well, then the malware knows that, hey, something has happened, and maybe I should do my anti-debugger function instead of... Yeah, question?
Another question.
Yeah.
Do you know if query performance counter and get tick count, when you, these are in C, if you look at them in assembly, will you see the RETSC used then, or is it implemented in a different way?
To repeat that. Yeah, there's a question here that if you're looking into the assembly code of these two Windows API calls, if you would still see the RDTC assembly instruction. The answer to that is maybe. I haven't really looked into it, but I would assume that probably it is at least get tick count. Maybe query performance counter is something process specific, but get tick count should use the RDTSC.
These are API calls, so you will see the API calls in assembly.
And probably in the assembly, yes. If they aren't inlined in the malware. Okay. So, for a debugger to work, it has to have some kind of, you have to get information and act accordingly. And of course, you can interfere with that debugger functionalities. I'm going through three examples here as well. And here's thread local storage, TLS callback. Going through a little exception, exception handling and inserting interrupts. Okay, so TLS callbacks. These are mostly not a problem, but it's not often used by legit software. And what TLS callbacks is, it's executing code before the main entry point. So I can't really see a a use for this, except hiding your code in a different place. But what you can do is set breakpoints on the TLS callbacks. You can configure the debugger, to automatically stop on the entry point of TLS callbacks. And in IDA, you can press the hotkey Control-E to show a table of potential show table of TLS callbacks, if there are any. When you press Control-E in IDA, you should most of the time see start or main, but sometimes there's a TLS callback entry point there as well. But you can also manually check in the PE header inside the image empty headers and image optional headers. There we'll see a table of TLS callbacks if there are any. But the moral here is set, configure a debugger to automatically stop on the entry points of TLS callbacks, and then you won't really have this problem. Okay, exceptions. By default, the debugger pauses or traps the program runtime when an exception happens, because an int tree is a single step exception at a breakpoint exception, and that is thrown, and the debugger stops everything that's going on. But it also stops every other exception by default. And what a malware author can do, he can maybe set up another code flow that when an exception is thrown, the malware, when in standard runtime, would just jump into exception handling and do all this malicious activity and jump back. But when you are having a debugger attached, it jumps to the debugger, and the debugger says, maybe not do anything with this, or just go to the next instruction, and you're skipping all this section with malicious code. This is also often used with timing checks. Instead of actually stepping, you can have an exception thrown, the debugger stops the program, you continue running the malware, but still it's gone far too long, and the malware knows that, well, it's been stopped, the exception stopped the program, and there is a debugger present. So I haven't seen any cases where a debugger needed to handle every exception, like divided by zero exceptions and some write to memory that's not accessible, stuff like exceptions like that. The debugger don't need to handle those. Those are meant for programmers to see what's going wrong in the code and edit the code and get the program to work again. So you could smart to maybe set up the debugger to pass those automatically to the program, except in tree and single step exceptions. Those are quite useful to have. Okay. So you could insert interrupts into your program and just have the malware know that when there are an entry, just pass it and go to next, and pass and go to next, pass, go to next. And this could be used to annoy analysts to just have 100 interrupts inside a short function, so the malware analyst has to manually go next, go next, go next, and just demoralize. Also used with timing checks. But as I said, int tree is an exception, and exception is thrown. So you could, for instance, put in an int tree. It's the int tree is run, and it throws an exception to the malware. And if the malware was running without a debugger, it would know that, okay, handle this by running my malicious code. But when a debugger present, you see, oh, it's just another int tree. All right, just go to the next instruction, and you're skipping a whole section of malicious code. That's quite a tricky one to see or realize. And also, you have this opcode CD03, which is which is a breakpoint, but it's messes with the Windbag debugger, because it stops the program but silently advances the EAP instruction pointer by 1 byte. So you could see in the disassembly perfectly normal code, but when it's shifted 1 byte, it's malicious code or something else. But I believe this has been patched since the book, but I tried to look up patch notes, but I could not see it. But it should be unpatched, because this is quite a big thing. But if you are scared, maybe not use WinDebug, or just look for the opcode of CD03. Okay, there are still more in this section. You have an int2d, which is a breakpoint for kernel debugger, or the Windbag debugger. And it works on the same way as int3, just another code for it, so that you can have to remember more and look for more. And also you have this in-circuit emulator, or ICE, which is a undocumented Intel instruction set. Because telling people how your stuff works is probably bad, I guess. So the instruction set is making it easier to debug an ICE, but I couldn't really tell you what an ICE is, but it makes it easier. In assembly, it's an ICE BP, or opcode F1, and it is a single step exception. Stop the program here and wait for further instructions. And this could be used to ignore or to have exception handling, change code flow, as I said earlier, used in the same way as everything else. But don't step over ICE BP, because that's when stuff happens and you lose exception handling. Because it's a little strange, because when you're single stepping over an ICE BP, then another single step exception is thrown, is thrown too, so you're missing one exception handling. It's a little strange explained in the book, but off the book, I have never seen this in the wild. Quite a strange set of instructions. So don't single step over ICE BP, just run the code, run to this instruction, for instance, or just F9 to next breakpoint, and this should not be a problem. Ooh. Okay, so debugger vulnerabilities. Always take steps to protect yourself for 0 days. You are never safe. It's honest, you are never safe. The book has a lot of examples that focus on only version 1. For instance, you can mod the PE header, just modify a single byte, and only crashes and you can't use only. Moral here, don't use only version 1. Use everything else than first version of only. You can also... If you also be on the lookout for output debug string and this string format, because a lot of this %s could make the debugger crash because it can't format the string in the right way. The book is not comprehensive in the debugger vulnerabilities. Yes? Okay, so on to the conclusion. There is a finite ways to check for debugger. They aren't infinite. There are some flags you can check, and there are some calls you can look for. And to work around this as a malware analysis, you can hook API calls or set breakpoints at API calls, install plugins onto your debugger, or processes that run on your Windows system that forcefully feed wrong information. Or you can do as B and just set breakpoints and flip flags when you need to. But a developer, malware developers, could outsmart you. So there are always so many places you can check. There are many different ways and smart ways to check them. Also, use new debuggers. These are smarter. They remember where they set their own breakpoints and just ignore all those int tree that have been written into the code. There are also less known vulnerabilities. Could still be zero-day vulnerabilities or other vulnerabilities, but are less known, less used. And always protect yourself. Use virtual machines, remote debugging, and so forth. But yeah, remember API calls, remember timing checks, and scanning. Yep, that's time for a break. And I guess 50 minutes?
15.
15,
not
50. Yeah, it's a little much.
We start again at
9:15.
I'm going to ask one question.
Yes, one question.
On the checks, in order to perform them as for the malware, do you have to run them in a separate thread?
There's a question here. If all these checks have to be run in different threads? Was that the question? No, you don't have to, but would be quite useful to, because debugging in multiple threads are a pain, and would be, well, it would be harder to detect if you're running in different threads, but you don't have to. Most malware is single threaded, so you don't have to run in different threads. All right.
Okay.
9:15. All right, welcome back. We are going to continue with the next chapter, but before that, I'm just going to make something maybe a little more clear, because there was a question from the audience that if about the code flow changes when you, for instance, put in a int tree or breakpoint into your code, and the debugger handles it, and how the code flow changes, because an int tree is single step exception, and you can use that in ordinary malware just to throw an exception and handle that exception. And when the malware runs by itself, it throws an exception, the handler takes that exception and says, okay, now I want to run my malicious code. But when you have a debugger present, the debugger runs to the int tree, it stops. Maybe if you have a dumb debugger, it stops. And you say, okay, I don't want to stop here, run to the next instruction. And then you skip a whole lot of exception handling that could potentially be quite malicious. And that's I've seen that used in the wild. That's a really nice way, a smart way maybe, to change the code flow and confuse the debugger, because you've just it never do anything bad, but when you're running it dynamically, it does everything bad. So yeah, hopefully that was answered some questions. All right. So, anti-virtual machine techniques, a game of wits, pretty much. Okay, so in this section, it's a little shorter section than the last. We're going through anti-VMware, in short. The book focuses on VMware, but most of this also include the VirtualBox as well, and probably other virtual programs. vulnerable instructions in VMs, and here are some techniques we're going through. And then a little section with tips from me, a little off the book, and then a conclusion. All right, so anti-VMware in short. So VMware leaves a lot of evidence behind on the file system, in process names and registry. It's just natural there are strings there that reference back to VMware. Another less commonly known is the MAC address of a virtual machine, because all MAC addresses start the three first bytes are vendor specific. Those are standard for every MAC. In VMware, that is 000C29. So you can change that, of course, but by standard, that's always the three first bytes in a VMware. And that malware can check and look if it's the same. Also, there are other hardware checks that's just named something VMware. That you can go through and check. And search through physical memory and not the virtualized memory in the VM or for the process, but go further in and check the host memory, but probably have to have admin rights to do that, but it's a possibility. And something you can do to mitigate a lot of these tests or checks are uninstalling VMware tools, but that's a hassle to work with. So I still have it just for convenience sake, and just have to be a little more vigilant when you are debugging. All right, so vulnerable instructions. Because VMs in general can't simulate every instruction. Kernel instructions are emulator, but not user instructions. What I mean here is that user instructions are mostly check this, get the value from that, do non-harmful activities. But kernel instructions could do potentially harmful instruction and get access directly to the system. So those are emulated on the virtual processor, but not the user instructions, because those are mostly, they should be non-harmful. That's like running a program with and without administrator rights, pretty much. But some instruction sequences will return different results when in a virtual machine than a physical machine or a host, if you will. Okay, so the SIDT, SGDT, or SLDT, and CPU ID. The book mentions that, but I haven't seen any reference to it in the book, but it mentions the CPU ID. Well, these instructions are user instructions, so they are executed directly on the host CPU. These access the interrupt description table registry, global description table registry, and local description table registry. There also the SIDT is the first, and the SGDT are the second, and the third one, and so forth. These are registry used by the operation system, and not much else. And each of these instructions puts an address on the host CPU registry. And if there are, and if the CPU is on x86 architecture, well, then the CPU will fill up with information about the real system and not the guest system, and that will, well, could diverge. So if the malware knows that when you're calling and you should get this information, and the function returns another information, is not synchronized, and you can see that maybe it's you are in a virtual machine. It's a little complicated, but we're going through a little techniques right here, different techniques right here. So the book goes through the red pill anti-VM techniques. So what it does is it uses the SIDT to set interrupt direct to the description table registry location into EIX. This is really operation system technicalities. That's quite hard to explain. But you don't need to know all the details. But we need to know that the fifth byte in this memory address, in the start of this memory address, is a signature to the memory base of the memory address. So if the fifth byte, if you go to this address, go to the fifth byte offset, and check if it's FF, well, then you are in a virtual machine memory address, a memory space. But this, as many other tests in the book, is unreliable on multi-core processors. I can't explain why, because those are operation system specific technicalities that I can't really, I haven't gotten into, because it's not relevant to malware analysis. But if you have a multi-core processor, you shouldn't be, it should not return the check VMware signature. Okay, so no pill technique. This relies on that the Windows don't use the local description table, but that VMware does use this table, because when you're then accessing this registry on a host machine, this will be returned as zero, but on a non-host machine it will return zero, but on a VMware it will return a non-zero value. And this uses the SGDT and SLDT instructions. But if you have disabled acceleration, the way you simulate instructions on the CPU, you will work around this. I haven't seen this used, so I can't watch for this technique. Okay, but this one I've seen a lot. query input output communication port. And what it does, it's the input output ports. You try to talk to the port used to communicate between the guest and the host. And the way you do that is that you, in assembly, use the instruction in, but you have to have some parameters set for this to work. So as you can see here, this only works if EAX equals VMX in hex, or as you can see here in this red numbers here, or hex value here. And the ECX is set to an action. And in this example, the action is check for VMware version. And then the result of that com query is set to EBX or var1c. So you don't have to really have to know all the specifics on this check. You just have to be on the lookout for the in instruction and those numbers, the hex values. And if you see those three within suitable reach of each other, well, then you have this query communication port test. So as you can see here, you just compare the result with VMX, and if it's equal, then you have you are in a virtual machine. Okay, so the STR instruction in assembly, it retrieves from the segment task register, the current executing task. And this value may differ from a native system than on a guest system. This is also Windows or system-specific technicalities that I can't really explain why they may differ. There's a figure 7.2 in the book that's comprehensive and goes through the instruction set that is this check. But this does not work on multi-core processors, so anything new won't be affected by this, and it will not give a positive result on this VM check. But if you want, check the book for the example one question.
One question. Do we have processors that are not multi-core anymore?
No.
Repeat the question.
So the question is, do we have any processors that aren't multi-core? Well, no.
Not a normal computer. Then the next question is, does not work for multi-core processors. Does that mean that it doesn't work if more than one of the processors are used, or if the program runs on just one core, will it still work? Do you understand?
Yeah,
that?
Yeah.
Repeat the question.
The question was, would this... if the program has to run on different cores, or the malware have to run on different cores for this to not work? Was that the question? Or
somewhat like, if the implementation of the software is such that it runs on one core, will then the test work? I don't know if the question makes sense. But
yeah. Well.
See if you can repeat.
Yeah. So. This is multi-core processors on virtual machines. So if you set the virtual machine to have more CPUs, as it says in the settings, that pretty much means more cores. It's something with the memory registry and how those work together in the current executing tasks, because I believe those can, you can, yeah. Well, this check might return positive if you have only one core on the virtual machine. I'm not really sure about that. But just pretty much all of these checks in the book have more cores on the virtual machine and have a good CPU on your host PC, and this should not be a problem. These tests are quite outdated. So I'm sorry I can't answer the question in a smart and understanding way. Okay, so what do you pretty much have to look out for? Even though they might not work, it's still nice to know if the malware is trying to do something sneaky. So here's a list of the instructions I went through, plus the SMSW and CPU ID, which is also used for checking for virtual machines. But the book don't have any examples on how they are used. But still, these are instructions mostly used for checking for virtual machines. But if you are encountering an instruction that you haven't seen before, or not so much used instructions, it might be used for detecting virtual machine or maybe something else fishy. So I would highly recommend Googling instructions when you are not 100% sure what it does. But this is a list of nice to know, be on the lookout for instructions. Okay, so little tips and tricks and things and stuff. There are tons of scripts and plugins and programs that you can use and guides to make your virtual machine less detectable. The book has some examples, but they are all old, and the scripts and plugins might not be updated or up to date, or there are workarounds now that these don't take in considerations. But when you're working with malware and anti-virtual machine techniques, you get a kind of sense of what they are looking for and what they're doing. So then you can find your own plugins that works, or make your own. When you are starting to get good at your field, then you can start making your own. Also, the book has some VMware settings that you can look into to make it less detectable, but I haven't used it. Okay, and as I have said earlier, you are never safe. It is possible to escape from virtual machines. And I highly recommend Googling talks and white papers and such to look into how to escape virtual machines, because then really nice to know, just to see how it's done, and see if it's been patched in your version of virtual machine program. And if you're like me, I like to work with a shared folder. But when you're doing that, remember to have a read-only on the shared folder, because I've had examples, not me personally, but I have a colleague that's accidentally run CryptoLocker and cryptated whole of his shared folder, and that's a lot of useful information that lost forever. And if you're really lucky, it goes even further into your system through that folder, but that's unlikely. Or you can do as I do and remote debug, and then you have either virtual machines or remote dedicated hardware that's dedicated to running malicious code, and that's all it does. You just wait for a file and a connection to your debugger of choice. Okay, so a little off the book. How can you as a person tell the difference between a virtual machine and a native system? For instance, here's a top of my head things that I know are most could be different. For instance, resolution. If it's a smaller resolution that normally used, like 980 resolution, or if the HDD or the memory is really low, that you have a small hard drive or low set of memory. For instance, the black background paper haven't been changed from the Windows XP Green Hills or the standard Windows logo on Windows background with the logo, or maybe if the amount of installed programs are really small, that you only have the pre-installed programs, or if Chrome or Windows haven't been updated in a long time. Those are giveaways that you maybe be in a virtual machine that's only used for analyzing. And of course, amount of document in your My Document. Do they have all the same modifying date? Have they been copy-pasted on the same in the same time? Or internet history and cookies. If the system had been used, you can guess that they have been on the internet. And if the recycle bin is empty, that may be a giveaway that it's a virtual machine that's not used. And I'll quote, gotta use your smarts. I just have to think and be on the lookout for checks and strange file paths and registry lookup and things like that. I'm mostly used for detecting virtual machines. On a last note here, from me, a little off the book, anti-VM techniques are out. Many workstations now, in businesses, in government, are virtual machines, and you lose a lot of potential targets if you are really strict on your virtual machines. So most tests that are virtual machine on modern malware is anti-sandbox. For instance, there the resolution is quite relevant because sandbox resolution is often 800 times 600, and if you are waiting for maybe 20 minutes before executing your malware, then you're bypassing sandbox solutions and some stuff like that. So have your analyzing environment system really lifelike. Windows XP is not lifelike. Windows XP is out. It's actually quite hard to get XP VM in general. So use Windows 7, use Windows 10 if you want, because if the malware can't run on 7 and 10, well, you got bad malware. It's rubbish, it can't pretty much infect anything. So lifelike systems that you're analyzing on is really really nice to have, but not to have sensitive information on it. Yes, as I said in the beginning, this chapter is really short. I have to apologize for that, because the book has a lot of examples to how to work around VM detection. But as I said, VM detection is out. It's anti-sandbox now. But still, you can go to the book and see the examples on what the book has mentioned and how to work around it. It could be... I guess you have to do it when you're doing the labs. So the book has some examples on popular techniques, but those techniques are out. You have to have really bad hardware and old Windows versions to have these to work. But you can set mental alerts or script and plugins that do it for you on the instructions SIDT, SGDT, SLDT, and so forth. But it's really nice to have a mental alert on these hex values that are VMX and VX, because these are quite recognizable numbers or hex values that are a lot used in detecting virtual machines and query communication port. if you are encountering a new instruction, it could possibly be bad disassembly, but also possibly a new way to detect virtual machine or a new way to exploit your system to get further access. So be on the lookout for things that are new to you and Google it, research it before you maybe execute it. That's a tip for me. Yes, the questions and labs, for those that have any.
Let's see if there's any online. I'm wondering about the kernel instructions that you mentioned that are emulated.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Okay, so emulated instructions. Because when you are virtualizing a machine, you are telling it that you have these. This is the hardware on your virtual machine, and this is what you have to work with. And most of the hard, when you have set the CPU, how fast the CPU is, it's pretty much how much of the whole CPU you can use, how many cores of it, and how many threads, and so on. But when you are kernel instructions are instructions that directly affect the Windows operation system. You have kernel functions that is the same, and kernel instructions in assembly that directly affect memory usage, system specific flags, or editing stuff on the system. And those are kernel instructions. And those are emulated in the virtual machine and never leaves the confinement of the virtual machine. So they are. So the system thinks that you have written to a memory address or written someplace or another, but they have never left. They have never directly affected the host CPU. These are virtual machine technicalities that are I haven't gotten into. But they are.
So the kernel instructions are confined to the VM.
Yeah.
The user instructions are not.
Yeah, they're not, because there are many more times user instructions that are run through than kernel instructions, and those are just directly pipelined to the host CPU. Because emulating, it takes more cycles to emulate than to run it directly, and therefore you have a higher run time, or it uses longer time to run the instruction, and therefore you have quite a heavy performance hit when you are emulating than you are running on directly.
So then, user instructions won't touch the virtual CPU.
Yeah, the user instruction won't be run on the virtual CPU. That's correct. Yeah, a risk trade-off that you. Most user instructions aren't that.
Okay. Okay. Then I'll move closer to the microphone so you can hear me. Thank you, Alexander, for two very nice lectures. And then I'll. We will both be available for labs if anybody wants to do the labs for chapter. Is it 15 or 16? 16 and 17, right?
Yeah.
I have a couple of remarks that I can that I want to go through before we end this recording, and you can if you want to go there, then it's we don't have to. It's not that cramped up here. I just want to add a comment on the anti-virtual machine that's out. That's absolutely true. That's so much legitimate computing platforms are running on VM now that the malware writers really limit themselves if they don't target the machines that run on or virtual machines as well. And also the XP is outdated. We know that. We've been struggling with that all semester. I have been in contact with one of the authors of the book, just to ask him if there's a new book on the way. He couldn't promise anything, but the earliest will be next year. I'm hoping. But still, a lot of the basic techniques that we've been covering in this class and that you've learned is still valid, even though it's XP, it's easy to transfer to other operating systems. Now we have two lectures left of this course before the frightening exam. And that is week 19 and 20. I believe it's May 8th and May 15th. Those are the two last lectures. Since I've had to drop one of the lectures due to some illness in my family, I will prioritize to lecture chapter 13 in one of those 2 days. It's data encoding. It's something that would have been useful for you to have before assignment 2, but these things we can't control these things. So that's the way it is this year. I'm also Gunnar Alendal, a PhD student here, also works for Kripos. He had an excellent presentation at the Malware Forum, the Security Forum, and I've invited him up to do a lecture on his work one of those 2 weeks. So he hasn't decided yet if it's the 8th or the 15th, but that's more a bonus, just to show you that there's a world outside assembly code. So that's what's happening. And I am considering using some time, one of those 2 days, to give a summary, just a very brief overview of what we have covered in this class, to try to give you some hints on what you should focus on for the exam. If you have any questions or particular things you want summarized or focused on in one of these two last lectures, then please send me an email and I'll see whether I can cover it or at least comment on it before we end. So send me any questions you have. And also, if you haven't done it already, send me an email on your preferred date for the oral examination. I know some of you have done it. If you haven't, then please do. If not, I'll just pick a random one of those 2 days for you. And that's fine. But if you have a day that you prefer, then send me an email. And also, let's see what else. If you have questions with the assignment now, please include Kato and Sergey in the email, as I still have some limited capacity right now. But include me in the email as well. If I have time, I'll do my best to answer. So that's what I think I have now. Any questions from the audience or online? All right, then as usual, I'll be available in Blackboard until 12 if you want to start in the lab and ask us questions. Have a nice day.